Hello, it's Tom here. We've got a great episode of Last Orders for you today, but before we get into that, I just want to let you know about Spiked's very exciting new daily newsletter. It's called Today on Spiked. Sent out every day at 6 p.m, it gives you your essential roundup of all of the content that we've published that day, along with exclusive commentary from the Spiked team that you won't read elsewhere. And it is also completely 100% free. We're publishing more and more these days, so if you want to make sure that you never miss an article or an essay or a podcast, stop what you're doing right now and go to spiked-online.com/newsletters and sign up to Today on Spiked. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/newsletters and Today on Spiked. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is a show about freedom, the nanny state and censorship, and for the foreseeable future at least, lockdown. Today we discuss zero COVID, Facebook unfriending Australia, and the free speech fight back on campus. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater and I'm joined today, as ever, by Chris Snowden, Director of Lifestyle Economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How's lockdown treating you down there on the South Coast?
Hi, Tom. I hate it, of course, but we've got to get through this.
But I'm also delighted to say that we're joined today from Australia by Nick Cater. Nick is Executive Director of the Menzies Research Centre. He's a columnist for The Australian and a much-loved Spike contributor on all things Australian politics. So, Nick, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. It's great to be making my Last Orders debut. And I can say, actually, because it was 10 o'clock at night here, that it is actually Last Orders time. So if I was in the pub, that's what I was doing. But I'm here talking to you guys anyway, so that's even better.
There we go. And first of many appearances, I'm sure. So to start off with, we're going to talk a bit about zero COVID. Now we've got the arrival of the vaccines, countries, particularly in Britain in the past week, are starting to talk about the route out of lockdown, the route out of this pandemic. Boris Johnson has delivered his pretty glacial roadmap out of lockdown, which I'm sure we'll get into shortly. But there are some who want him to go even further. There are the advocates of zero COVID, the idea that we should try to essentially eradicate COVID before even thinking about easing restrictions and even then be ready to reimpose them at a moment's notice. And one of the models that you often hear being brought up by these advocates of zero COVID is, of course, Australia, which has taken a very different path to the UK. Certainly closed its borders very early, very few deaths, but also many ongoing restrictions and snap lockdowns. So, Nick, to kick us off, can you tell our listeners just a bit about how Australia has handled the pandemic and what we may or may not be able to learn from that here in the UK?
Yeah, well, we're sort of fortunate that we're a long way from anywhere. But early on, in fact, this was part of the strategy here, long before the World Health Organization declared a pandemic. They declared a pandemic here, and that was in order that they could basically shut off the international borders and then introduce quite a strict quarantine program from almost the start of this. So if you flew into Australia, you get marched off for 2 weeks detention in some shabby Holiday Inn somewhere, guarded by people with masks, and it's all quite horrible. But anyway, through that means we basically stopped it coming across the borders. And they have done some really clever other stuff, like very clever track and trace in some states. Health is run state by state, so there's a huge difference between states. But some of these have done it quite well. So, you know, from about week two, if I get on a train in Sydney and swipe my equivalent of an Oyster card, then they know where I am and they'll use that if there's an outbreak. So we've basically got rid of the thing, except for people coming into the country. And because governments, of course, are hopeless at doing anything, they've been very patchy at the way they've run those quarantine hotels. So occasionally it's seeped through. And then, and this is the scary part, you get the mother of all lockdowns. I think, had some of the heaviest lockdowns in the world, despite the fact we've had some of the lightest number of cases. So the idea that lockdowns are justified because of the scale of the pandemic is absolutely blown out the water in Australia. Lockdowns are justified because some governments like locking people down.
And Chris, feel free to comment on any of that in terms of Australia, but I'd also be keen, just because it is the week that Boris Johnson has announced his roadmap out of lockdown, what you make of it. It does seem incredibly cautious. And it's been interesting that even a couple, not all by any stretch of the imagination, of the kind of zero COVID camp seemed to be giving it kind of qualified praise. So this kind of 4-month stretch out of lockdown, this very cautious strategy, it's not zero COVID, is it? But is it, it's something closer to it than we might like potentially.
Yeah, I think it seems to me too long. I think the government was right to say they're going to look at the data rather than the dates, but it's not following through on that. It's given us a bunch of dates 5 weeks apart for no real reason and saying that this is how it's going to be. This is a plan. Well, I mean, I think we should look at data. Absolutely. I mean, I think broadly speaking, that once we've got to a situation where we've got, say, fewer than 3,000 cases a day, fewer than 300 hospital admissions a day for COVID, and assuming the vaccines work as well as they seem to be working, which is to say that you've got kind of more than 90% protection from just one shot, then I think that's the time when you open up. Perhaps we could go back to a tier system for a few months while everybody else gets vaccinated. Boris Johnson said in Parliament that he wasn't going to do that because the rates are pretty much the same all over the country. I mean, it's just totally wrong. The rates vary enormously across the country. Seems to me a quite a good time, actually, to have a tier system. And I think by Easter time, you'd be in a position where pretty much everywhere would be in tier one or tier two. You vaccinate everybody else, but by that time, you've vaccinated everybody over the age of 60, and you're well on your way to vaccinating everybody over the age of 50. So why string it out till July? Why are we assuming we're going to have a worse epidemic of this this summer than we did last summer, when we've got so many people who are going to be immune to the virus? There's a theory that Boris has deliberately underpromised so he can give everyone a nice surprise in May or June. I don't know. But I think if things go as well as I suspect they will go, and assuming that the reopening of the schools doesn't lead to a, you know, the R going above one, I think we're going to start looking pretty stupid in May or June, potentially, when the rest of Europe has opened up and they've vaccinated far fewer people. We've vaccinated everybody who needs vaccinating, and we still haven't opened the pubs. So follow the data, not the dates, I would say.
Nick, what's the picture like in Australia at the moment in terms of the route out of this? Obviously, I know that Britain has had the advantage of this vaccine rollout going ahead earlier than many other countries, but what are the discussions like in Australia at the moment about when lockdown, or at least the current regime of restrictions, might start to ease as we go forward?
I suppose it's more lockout than lockdown, you know, and that we're locking people out of the country. And I think the government has said, and nobody has contradicted this, it's unlikely to be free international flights in and out of Australia in terms of being able to come in and out when you want and not being shoved into some gulag hotel until probably at least the end of this year. So, you know, forget if you want to come over for the New Year fireworks. And that, you know, the candid advice from the health minister here, who's not a bad chap, incidentally, is that there's only one virus disease that we've ever stamped out, and that's smallpox. So we're unlikely ever to get rid of this altogether. So I just think governments all around the world, and particularly here where we've got a degree of leeway, have to take some risks, right? They have to say, well, okay, there's going to be a level of it in the community, but we'll get our health services and everything else up to date so they can deal with that, and we'll of course protect the nursing homes and the elderly and the vulnerable, but the rest of us have got to go about our business, because we keep hearing these metrics about, you know, the spread of the virus, which often the predictions turn out to be way overestimated, as I'm sure Chris should back up. But what we never hear, of course, is the cost to small business, the cost to lives, the cost to families, the cost in terms of suicide. And of course, here in Australia, as in the rest of the world, those statistics are looking pretty grim.
And just staying with you, Nick, on the topic of the kind of costs of lockdown, particularly on civil liberties, because it's very easy for us to have kind of very national conversations about restrictions. But it does seem that whilst we've all been suffering under some pretty horrendous limits on our freedoms, there's been a particular kind of authoritarianism in certain parts of Australia, very stringent lockdowns, as you were alluding to earlier, you know, even stories of pregnant women being arrested in front of their kids for trying to organise a lockdown protest on Facebook, etc. Could you give our listeners a bit of a flavour of that stuff?
Look, for those of us who'd always thought of Australia as one of the freest countries on earth, this has been a wake-up call, and it's been confined to a few states, principally Victoria, which is run by a premier people now call Dictator Dan, and that's how he acts. And he granted himself, well, first of all, they passed these emergency laws, which basically make him and the chief health officer, you know, number one and number two czar, and then they do anything they want, doesn't have to go to parliament. And so when they had this outbreak last July in Victoria, which was entirely the government's fault, incidentally. It wasn't the people's fault. It was the government's fault for putting a dodgy team of cheapo security guards in charge of a hotel. So they get this outbreak. It's not a huge outbreak by your standards, but it's by here. Mm. And you have the most horrendous lockdown for several months, including a nighttime curfew, which I could never understand. I mean, is the virus spread more at night or something or what? You know, what is there to stop people going out, people getting arrested for taking their bins to the curbside? And as you say this, you may have seen the video. This is a pregnant woman in her pajamas, arrested in her own kitchen, handcuffed in her own kitchen for a Facebook post, which is allegedly advertising an anti-lockdown rally. This is just such a horrendous abuse of what we thought was our civil rights and an intrusion by the state into our everyday lives, and on a very few cases. So I think Australia is the place where it shows that these lockdowns and the heavy-handed policing and the complete abandonment of the rule of law and habeas corpus, these things are just being unleashed by certain governments and leaders of governments who just really wanted to have a go at this all along. You know, that it was the thing probably they most admired about the Soviet Union, and now they get the chance to put it into practice.
And Chris, just finally before we move on, there's still some advocates of zero COVID who are suggesting that we should now double down in the UK, that we should aim to treat this like we did with measles and try and, again, kind of push it down. But was it ever really a viable strategy in this country, because of some of the things that Nick talked about? We don't necessarily have some of the geographic advantages, or just the cost to civil liberties would be far too intense to pursue this kind of thing.
I just think we had too many cases, far too many cases. You know, we had a 3.5 month lockdown. It depends how you define lockdown, but I define lockdown ending when the pubs are open. The pubs opened on the July the 4th. We went into lockdown March the 24th. We had a 3.5 month lockdown. And by the end of it, we still had about 1,000 cases a day. And they were going down very slowly towards the end of that lockdown. It would have taken months after months to get it down to zero, and it would have required a much stricter lockdown. So we could do it. In theory, of course you could do it. You close the borders, which we never did, and you have a Wuhan-style lockdown for a few months. You can do it. The question is, will you then get people coming back in reinfected? Well, we're a lot closer to a lot of countries than Australia is. We can't stop people coming into Britain on dinghies. You know, hundreds of people a day sometimes. So, no, I'm not very confident that we would have kept it out for very long, and then we'd have to go into lockdown again. There are still people calling for the zero COVID, particularly in Scotland. Nicola Sturgeon said she's aiming for zero COVID. Had a head-to-head debate in the New Statesman this week with Gabrielle Scully, who is a public health fanatic. He still wants to do it. To me, it's like a scorched earth policy. You know, a year ago, there were basically just two options. Either you have a sort of Great Barrington Declaration, protect the vulnerable and let it spread through the rest of the population. That had a lot of downsides, not least the fact that a huge number of people would die. Or you could go zero COVID, which also has a huge number of downsides and is probably impractical in somewhere like England. And then the vaccines change the game. We don't need to make this horrible choice anymore. And yet there are still a few people fighting the last war. There's not many people, to be fair, still saying we should just have, you know, herd immunity the old-fashioned way, let it rip. But there are still some people who are just tied to this idea of zero COVID, which is, I think, just a genuinely fanatical approach at this point.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So let's move on to our next topic, and we're going to stick with Australia for a moment and the clash between the Australian government and Facebook and Google that has been watched keenly around the world, Facebook in particular, I should say. So in the past month, Facebook unfriended Australia, famously depriving Australian users of access to news on their platforms, the ability to share news stories. This was in response to a proposed law that would force Facebook and Google to pay news publishers for their content. And the backdrop to this, of course, is tumbling ad revenue in the old media, in contrast to soaring ad revenue on social media and these big tech platforms. and in general, just around the world, an appetite for various governments to bring big tech to heel for all kinds of different issues. So Facebook has just recently backed down. Certain amendments have been said they were going to be made to the law, but the law does seem to be going ahead. And there's a kind of broader question here, I guess, about not just what happens in Australia, but what happens around the world as it is being watched so keenly. So Nick, you wrote about this on Spike this week. Could you tell us a little bit more about this story and what you think is at stake in this big battle between Facebook and the Australian government?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot we worry about, social media and really the influence of Silicon Valley. The actual issue at point here was that social media platforms, like everybody else, should pay for copyright infringement. So if they use pieces from other newspapers, other news outlets that, you know, somebody has collected with a sweat of their own pen, then they should pay for that. And at first, you know, all the social media platforms said, oh, we're not doing that. But then Google came to its senses and is now striking agreements with Australian news companies to pay for content. But Facebook, you know, stood out and said it wasn't going to do it. And then lo and behold, last Thursday morning, we all woke up and half of Facebook was down. They'd taken down all the news websites, but not just that. Lots of other people. So our own, the Menzies Research Center's Facebook page was down for about 5 days until we could persuade them we're not actually a news outlet. You know, we're a public policy think tank, and they eventually put it back up. But there were worse cases than that. I mean, they took down fire brigades, for instance. So in Western Australia, where there's bushfires at the moment, they weren't able to issue those warnings. It was just a clumsy, heavy-handed bullying attempt by Facebook, which of course completely backfired on it. I mean, you imagine the reaction of everybody here. Well, Facebook, you know, why did we ever think they were our friends in the first place if they're going to behave like that? But I think what it's also brought to the fore is just absolute irritation with social media platforms, particularly Facebook and Twitter, for the censorship, the cavalier regard to privacy that they've shown, you know, the active political propaganda that they were willing to put out in the American elections and over COVID, I have to say, and the way they just pull an elected president's Facebook page down. I mean, this is just crazy. I mean, Donald Trump, the elected president of the United States, and Facebook decide, you know, out of their little headquarters in California that he's not to be heard. It's just appalling behavior. So it's been a reevaluation of what people think of Facebook, and it's crawling back now. It's saying it's going to pay a bit of money, but I think its standing here has gone down enormously. And I hope that it prompts other governments and individuals to just let Facebook know, you know, this kind of behavior is not the behavior of a company that really values free speech.
And Chris, what's your take on this story?
Well, I've read about it, but I'm not on Facebook. And one thing I couldn't quite work out from the articles I read about it was, is Facebook just linking to news websites? Is that their offense that they're supposed to pay for? Or are they actually replicating, are they copying out the text and putting it on their website without driving the traffic to them? Can someone explain?
Well, they say it's individuals sort of posting links to news stories. And in some cases, you know, where there's a paywall up and people will, you know, copy the whole story and put it down on Facebook. They say it's other people doing this. But the question there is, that are they acting just as a carriage service? Are they just making their platform available like British Telecom or anybody else? Anybody can communicate anything. Or are they a publisher? And they've shown very clearly, particularly over the last year, they're a publisher. They edit. They choose what they're going to put on. They choose the rankings it's going to have. That's the behavior of a publisher. And if they're going to be a publisher, they have to behave as a publisher and pay for other people's material they run on their service.
See, that's where I disagree, because I think these platforms should be not regulated as publishers. I think if somebody is violating somebody else's intellectual property, as I would be doing if I copied something from the Australian and put it on my Facebook page, I think I should be the one liable for it, not Facebook. I mean, I think a lot of this looks like a shakedown of the old media trying to get money from the big tech companies, who actually in most cases are not taking their advertising in the first place. I mean, obviously newspaper advertising has gone down enormously, but it's mainly classified ads, job ads, car ads, all the stuff. And the Facebook and Twitter and these companies, they're not getting that revenue by and large. Yeah, Google's making a lot of search revenue, but it's not at the expense of newspapers. It's companies in Britain, at least, like Auto Trader, for example, are taking the car advertising away from newspapers. So I think I disagree with you on this, Nick. I mean, for me, it's a bit of a Al-Qaeda versus ISIS situation anyway, government versus Facebook. You know, I've got no time for the big tech companies, but I would have less time, I think, for the government trying to regulate them. And this looks like the start of them not only trying to regulate them, but also just trying to extract money from them and then give them to rent-seeking organizations like newspapers.
Well, look, I have some sympathy with you on a broad principle point of view. We don't like government regulating. That's always a last resort. And we certainly don't like government regulating essentially a communications medium. But I think the dynamics here have changed. I don't know about in Britain, but certainly here, the newspapers and other media complain with some justification. I think that a lot of online advertising, which is where a lot of the money is now, is going through Google, those little things that pop up on your screen and whatever. So they are losing revenue. But I think, you know, more to the point, you've got a behemoth here. And, you know, normally we'd expect if a company behaves badly, people will go to a company that gives them a better service. But what Facebook has done was when they had a competitor, Impala, they actively did everything they could to shut down their competitor. So this is a normal competitive commercial capitalist behavior, in my view. It's the bullying of somebody who's gained market dominance and will use anything to keep it. And under those circumstances, I think even those people we great admire, like Friedrich Hayek, would say there is a role for government to control anti-competitive behavior.
Yeah, I agree with that. The way they snap up their competition is highly dodgy, but I think that's a different issue. That's more of a kind of monopolies and mergers commission kind of issue, whereas this seems to be, I think, much shakier business in which, you know, you've got the old media essentially lobbying the government. The government wants to stay on the right side of the media. And everyone hates big tech companies, often for quite justifiable reasons, and you've just given one there. But I don't think that this is a valid one.
But on that, Chris, just because we've talked a bit about the issue of big tech before on this podcast, and whilst this particular law, as far as you're concerned, might not be a reasonable way of actually trying to intervene in these companies, it does seem like they are trying to have their cake and eat it on a lot of other topics. Nick, they're talking about the question of how they rank certain stories, suppressing certain stories. I mean, is there not a kind of reasonable case that even libertarians could get on board with, that when they're dealing with issues that affect not just certain products that they sell, but basically broadly free speech and democratic debate and all the rest of it, that they need to be neutral at the very least? And they're certainly not being neutral at the moment. Is that not something that we could all get behind as far as getting these big tech companies to uphold?
Yeah, and I came up with my policy live on air when we had Tamandra on a month or two ago. I worked out what I think needs to happen, which is we don't treat them as publishers who are liable for the content people put up. We treat the individuals liable for that. But the quid pro quo is that they have to allow everybody free speech. They can't just kick people off. It has to be open to everybody. I think something along those lines is the way to deal with these companies.
Yeah, which I think is the way Poland's dealing with it, right?
Oh, really?
They're threatening to fine Facebook or whoever if they shut legitimate people off. They're saying you're operating as just a neutral carrier, then you can't discriminate against people.
Yeah, good. That sounds perfect.
I think both approaches are valid, but I do think, and let me go, look, I have to confess, I was a journalist for most of my career, so I have my heart in journalism, but there has been a huge degrading of journalism across the Western world, in Britain and in Australia. And this is because newsrooms have shrunk and there are fewer and fewer journalists. And this is not good, I don't think, for democracy. I think when a state premier, for instance, stands up and he's only got one journalist asking him questions, whereas when I was covering state politics 25 years ago in South Australia, there'd be 10 journalists. They're not under the scrutiny they are. And so to that extent, I think we have to protect companies that employ professional journalists, or not protect them, but at least ensure that they're not disadvantaged by people who can just lift their news for nothing.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So finally, let's move on to freedom of speech on campus. So this is a bit of an evergreen issue in recent years, but it's come to a point in over the course of the past couple of weeks as the British government has brought forward plans to try and deal with the issue of campus censorship. It wants to appoint this free speech champion tasked with making sure universities and even students' unions are upholding legal duties to maintain freedom of speech. It wants cancelled academics and students to have legal recourse, even an avenue for institutions that don't uphold these values to be fined by the regulator. So campus censorship is something that's raged as an issue kind of across the entire Anglosphere, really. And these proposals come after a series of scandals and bans that we've seen, not just in the UK, but in the US, Australia as well, which I'm sure we'll get into. Yet at the same time, there still seems to be a big denial that this is even a problem at all. A lot of people making very pernickety points as to why this is entirely overblown. So is this the right way to tackle that? How do we tackle this issue? Is it a myth, as some people are suggesting? I imagine we don't think that's the case. But so, Chris, without wanting to get into the detail of these proposals necessarily, what has been striking is the refusal to see this as an issue at all. But surely the issue of cancel culture on campus and off is a big one. How can anyone deny that at this point?
I don't know. There's been so many obvious examples of it. And Spiked have been fantastic in creating their league table, showing very clearly that some places are really bad at it. Some places are pretty good. Buckingham University, give credit to them for having almost total free speech. But yeah, things have changed enormously over the last, I don't know, what, 20 years? Probably less than that, isn't it? The Cultural Revolution was such a short time ago, since about 2013 or something, I guess, that you have to feel that something has to be done. And it's a bit like the big tech thing in a way. These universities get a lot of privileges from the government. They get a lot of money from the government. And I think, again, there needs to be a quid pro quo, that organizations that are explicitly designed to encourage thought and debate shouldn't try and ban thought and debate.
No, it is quite striking. I mean, whilst I have generally been sceptical of this attempt by the British government to kind of launch what you might call a kind of pro-free speech crackdown, I think on the one hand, there is a remarkable kind of overestimation of how much of an intrusion these rules are. You know, it is just about them getting to uphold existing legal duties. But at the same time, as you say, it's just the refusal to admit that this is at all a problem. Like, our research found that when we last did it, more than half of campuses were explicitly banning certain ideas and ideologies. There was a fascinating policy exchange report last year that found half of academics would be uncomfortable being sat with a known Leave supporter at lunch, which I think, really? Again, just shows that this is not just a kind of formal problem of the university has these bans, the students' union has this no platform policy. There is a culture of censorship in these places. And I suppose that's the thing that makes me slightly more sceptical, is the fact that if, as we see in the US, which still has quite strong free speech protections on campus, if you stop censorship happening on a formal level, it will start to happen on more informal levels. It will just go into, this person isn't promoted. It will go more into mobs showing up rather than a no platforming taking place. So I guess that's where my skepticism creeps in. But Nick, tell us what you think about this issue, but particularly, I guess, how it's manifested on Australian campuses, because it does seem to be very much an Anglosphere phenomenon.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's manifest in many of the same ways: academics being dismissed for going against conventional wisdom, denial of academic freedom, no platforming of people on university campuses, all the same things. I think, you know, your point that the universities don't even recognize this, I think that's right. And I think Helen Pluckrose's wonderful book came out last year, Cynical Theories, explains some of the background of this. We're dealing with a new, perverse, depressing ideology of what she calls applied postmodernism, where, you know, they actually do believe that words are dangerous, and that if you say certain things, it's dangerous to the people on campus. And so they've arrived at this totally illiberal position, not even knowing that it's illiberal. As to what you do with it, I'm interested about that code of conduct, I guess, that Boris Johnson's proposing. We put something in place here about a year ago. It's quite a good code, but of course the universities ignore it. The debate here is, I think, as in Britain, of course the universities rely for a lot of their funding on the government and the government's largesse. So if they don't enforce this code, should we not fund them? Should we defund them? And instinctively I want to say yes, but aren't we then falling into the trap we accuse them of falling into, of denying academic freedom, if we say, look, I'm so, you know. So I think it's a tricky debate. And in particular here, I think the particular problem here is that we've got some very good universities, a few of them, but we've got a lot of very ordinary universities with very ordinary academics who have very little brain, who latch on to, you know, critical race theory, queer theory, anti-colonialism, all the rest, and treat it like a sort of theology, a sort of religion. And the students come out not knowing anything else. So I think if we could shut down a large proportion of the universities, concentrate on the good ones, and get rid of a lot of the half-baked academics, I think that might help us too, as well.
I'm curious to how this is actually going to work. I know you know a lot more about this than I do. But, I mean, one of the big issues is this no platforming thing, right? So let's say Lancaster University as an organization that invites Jermaine Greer, and then there's a big protest, and then they decide to disinvite her. What's the regulator going to do about this, if anything?
Well, the big innovation of what they're proposing seems to be to try and extend the existing legal duty for free speech to students' unions, which previously had a carve-out as being separate, private, member-led organisations, which would, in effect, try to compel them not to know platform people, really, outside of groups that were just actually prescribed by law or they had a reasonable suspicion might show up and engage in illegal speech as the law would currently determine it. And that's a kind of tricky issue insofar as, on the one hand, you don't really necessarily want the government interfering with private organisations like that. And for a long time, I'd argue against getting involved with students' unions, because whilst they are lost to this woke nonsense at the moment, that is largely because they're quite undemocratic. You know, you barely get double-digit turnout in student union elections, and it is just kind of very much the run by a clique. But at the same time, student unions, it's an issue because they get a lot of their money from universities now. They've just become kind of arms of the university. Partly, I blame this on students drinking less and less. They're getting less money from beer taking, so they have to go yeah. cap in hand to the campus most of the time. So I think that's how they think they're going to try and settle this. Because as you say, so much of this is students unions, and that was always the problem. But I think what the aim here is to extend that kind of public duty to uphold free speech, that legal duty to students unions in some kind of way. And that's how I think they think they're going to get a grip on this.
I think, Tom, you're right. I think the decline in drinking that cohort is a very worrying development, along with, I think, and it may be associated with it, the decline in the sense of humour, the disappearance of a sense of humour. But I kind of agree with Christopher on this. I think it's good that government lays down some standards, but how you enforce them is another thing. And in any case, you know, the nature of wokeism is it's always on the lookout for some way to demonstrate its own moral superiority and the worthlessness of any contrary view. So if you manage to overcome deplatforming, for instance, or you stop them chopping down statues of perfectly good people, they'd find something else to do it. Don't know what that is. There's a sort of urge there. So in a sense, you've got to go back the cause of it. And I think that is an academic question, this total corruption, particularly the social sciences, but spreading right across the curriculum now by applied postmodernism. You've got to attack it at an intellectual level and show that a liberal approach, you know, the approach we've had for centuries has served us very well, is actually much superior to this very, very negative, illiberal type of thinking.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated.